So that's an interesting point you make, because I think that one of the, since this is a therapy session.
Yeah, let's go.
One of the sort of discoveries that I made as I went back and was looking at some of my early writing was that I always had this impulse to make people a little bit uncomfortable with my writing.
Wow. I mean, you're pulling it off.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Sad Me of the Past, where we invite an established writer to revisit a piece they wrote in their tender years. That piece may fill them with affection, regret, nostalgia, embarrassment, relief, delight, anguish, all of the above, or something else entirely. Every infant must take those early, brave, awkward steps when learning to walk. We writers must make our own early, brave, awkward efforts as we set out to master our craft. So let's travel back to that ancient time when we were bursting with hubris or scared to death, drunk with language or paralyzed by it, determined to become a writer or terrified that we didn't have the stuff. I'll show them, we thought. But what did we show, really, and to whom? Hey, everybody. Welcome to Sad Me of the Past. I'm Stephen Lovely, director of the Iowa Young Writers Studio.
And I'm Lauren Haldeman, the senior editor of the Writing University.
And I'm Danny Colacci, director of the Magid Center for Writing here at the University of Iowa. And there is a certain energy to Iowa City around this time of year. The leaves are falling, students are lounging around campus in the crisp autumn air, and homecoming, that beautiful, famed tradition of generous nostalgia, brings with it the return of those who have left these hallowed halls, but have finally found their way back, even if all too briefly. We here at Sad Me of the Past are jubilant today because we get to celebrate our own homecoming right here in the studio with today's guest, the amazing and thoughtful and hyper-talented prose and television writer, Lila Bayok. Lila Bayok earned her MFA in fiction right here at the University of Iowa's Writers' Workshop and spent 5 years on the editorial staff of The New Yorker before beginning a career in television. Her work on such shows as, if you've heard of them, Watchmen, The Leftovers, Castle Rock, and Manhattan have received numerous awards, including 2 Writers Guild of America awards and an Emmy. Lila has multiple Lila has multiple television and feature projects in development, and along with her family, she divides her time between Los Angeles and her home state of Montana. But today, finally, Lila is back in another home here in Iowa City with us, and we couldn't be happier. Please join me in welcoming to Sad Me of the Past, Lila Bayok.
Woo!
Thank you, guys.
Hi, Lila.
Welcome,
hi,
Lila.
It's
so great to have you.
I do feel like I'm home. It's so nice to be here.
It's a good time of year, too, in Iowa City.
Well, yes, it's very interesting because it is, let's see, we're recording this in late October.
Yeah.
And this week has been in the low 80s.
Mm-hmm.
Not the Iowa I remember.
Mm-mm.
Yeah, it'll get there. We'll get there.
Just come back in February.
Give it some time.
You'll get what you need.
You know, yeah. I think I won't come back in February, but thank you for the offer.
Darn.
But at least the leaves are very beautiful.
The leaves are gorgeous.
Yes.
So,
yeah.
You know what they call that out east? Leaf peeping.
Yes.
Oh, right.
I've been doing
it. Sounds wrong.
It does sound wrong, but it's strange. Like if you go to Vermont, people are leaf peeping.
Well, they take whole trips to do that, right? Like it's.
But shouldn't there be another name for it?
Yeah.
Leaf viewing?
Yeah, I think that's better.
I don't know.
It kind of makes you feel like you should give the trees some privacy or something.
Or that you shouldn't be doing it.
I don't think they want privacy. Yeah.
Peeping sounds like you shouldn't be doing it.
The trees are there to be seen.
Yeah.
That's why they're out there.
Exactly. Yeah.
I remember the one time when I was thinking about death, which is all the time. One of my thoughts that calmed me down was like, oh, trees get really beautiful before they die. So that's nature being it's okay to die.
But they're only going to sleep. They're not dying.
Oh, you're right. So here come the thoughts again.
Yeah. So before you die, you're going to turn orange and yellow.
I mean, I just think, Stephen, that maybe death isn't what we imagine.
I don't think it is either.
Okay.
Next time on the podcast, what is death?
What is death?
Yeah. I mean,
we're in deep now.
We're in deep. So maybe the way we should start is, Lila, you've brought something with you to read today. I think what we really would love to do is kind of go back in time and try to get a sense of around the time you wrote this, before leading up to it, where were you? What age were you? What was your kind of world like? What is this piece of writing kind of come out of.
Great, great. Well, I have to tell you guys that I've listened to a number of episodes of this podcast, and as far as I can tell, this is sort of a therapy session for a writer.
Yes.
That
if you wanted
and
to.
We will be charging.
It gets broadcast for public consumption.
Yeah.
So I hope you take PPO. Do you? Is that?
Yes, we do, and do not follow. Is it HIPAA or FERPA?
Maybe both.
All of the information is going to be public.
Okay.
We do put a sound machine outside the door, you know.
Okay. All right. Well, that's
like a therapist's office.
Yeah. I don't have a therapist right now, so this is
here we go.
Have to do.
You have us three.
Just whatever you're comfortable with.
Yes.
Yeah. No pressure.
We time travel on this podcast.
Okay. Great.
We do a little bit of internal family systems.
I love it.
Yeah. We do a little DBT. I mean, we're all over the place.
Okay. Perfect. Well. Yeah, when I was asked to do this podcast appearance, I went down a kind of rabbit hole of trying to find an appropriate piece of writing because my parents are no longer married and they have both moved a number of times over the you know, 20 years or whatever. So my childhood possessions, to the extent that they still exist, are kind of like scattered all over. I don't really know where things are. I thought I knew where some things were, and then they turned out not to be there. And I sent various family members down their own rabbit holes. I thought I was going to have to read something from high school when I was the co-editorial page editor of my school newspaper. So I published a number of extremely strident and provocative editorials as a
we all have to
as a high schooler, and then at the last minute, my husband Sam, who's also a writer's workshop graduate, looked in a box of memorabilia that we have at our home in Los Angeles, and found this object that I've. That he then FedExed me overnight here to Iowa City.
Wow.
And so what I have brought is what I believe to be the first short story I ever wrote.
Yes.
Which was probably, I want to get, there's no date on it, but I, from context clues, I suspect I wrote it when I was about 8. Wow.
So for the listeners, because you can't see this, so two very important
picture.
Things. One is that the FedEx envelope is on the table as well. So this is a real
fresh out of the FedEx.
This is a real situation. And Sam, thank you for all of your hard work to get us
seriously
to get us this wonderful piece of art and writing. But then what Leela's holding is not just a short story; it is bound with a staple. Yeah, it's like laminated.
Is there a staple? You know what?
Did they sew it?
It's sewn.
Oh my god.
Where did you go to elementary school? I'm sorry. That is sewn.
You know what? Public elementary school, Missoula, Montana.
Damn. Yeah.
I think it's possible that my mother sewed it.
Okay.
Either way, that's a bound book.
It's a bound book. And the writing is by hand. It's in cursive.
Well, the dedication page is in cursive. The rest is...
Yes.
Whoa, drawings.
Oh, my God, the
drawings.
Pictures after. So I'm going to do it studio style.
And it is about the size of an iPad. It's kind of blue on the outside. There's a sort of an image. What's the material? Is that like a heavier paper?
I think it's blue construction paper.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
The title seems to be written with some kind of magic marker.
Okay. Like a highlighter,
yeah,
pink highlighter.
Mm-hmm. And then there's kind of a almost like a window cut into the construction paper, and in the window is a photograph of gorillas in a jungle.
This teacher understood the assignment,
yeah.
And you did too, I can tell.
Yeah, and remind us. So, what is the title of the piece?
It's called Elizabeth and the Jungle.
Elizabeth and the Jungle. So, okay, Leela.
So it's a travel writing.
Was it a school assignment? Do you remember?
I believe it was a school assignment. I don't have any memory of what the assignment was, or even honestly who my teacher was at this time.
Do you have any memory of
eighth grade? Like what? This was
you
were eight. I'm sorry.
I was eight. So I
Come
was
on, Steven.
So
yeah.
Third
so
grade.
Do you have,
maybe.
Yeah. Do you have any
so
memory
I
of?
I think I was in fourth grade.
Okay. And this is in Missoula. And
yeah.
Any other memories from that period? Like.
Well, my family had fairly recently moved to Missoula from another town in Montana. And so I think I was, you know, about a year into getting my bearings in this new school. And I think I was sort of just beginning to be interested in, I think I had always been a very verbal kid who was reading a lot from, you know, preschool on, just very oriented in that way. But I think that this was the very beginning of my interest in actually, like, writing.
Cool.
Wow. I don't know if we've ever been back to the very, very, very beginning with another
With
guest.
Rachel
That's
Yoder,
exciting.
We went back, I think, to Pretty, fifth grade.
Yeah, but this is, yeah.
Lila, when you got this in the mail and you opened
yes.
it.
Right.
So as Stephen was saying, you're in Montana at this point in your life. You've just kind of started writing. When you opened it, did you have any sort of like emotional response? Did you remember it at all?
Well, I think that I had re-encountered this at some point within the last several years when I was helping my mom move to a new house.
Yeah.
And so I think that at that time I had sort of taken a few special items and packed them up in a box and brought them back to Los Angeles. So it's not the first time I'm re-encountering this as an adult. I know that it's something that I think I had forgotten all about it, but my mom seems to have a strong memory of it.
Interesting.
Nice. And that may be because there is a mother character in the novella.
We are always, as a parent, I'm always looking for clues to, one, how I'm doing.
Yeah.
And, like, two, what my kid thinks of me. Mm-hmm. And we will be, it's a scavenger hunt through everything.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I think I wrote this when I was eight. I now have two children, one of whom is newly nine, so around the same age. And I am obsessed with everything my children write because, yes, you're like, oh, what is happening in your brain? You know, like you're always looking for clues. So
my kid asked to get on TikTok a couple years ago. And I said, okay, but you need a private account. And I need to follow you. And I'm telling you, this has been one of the best parenting moves because it's like he forgets that I'm watching.
Mm.
So I get like tons of insider information.
Yeah.
I get complaints about me.
Well, it's interesting because you mentioned, Lila, that there's like a mother character
yeah.
in here.
Yeah.
Do you remember? So it is typed on the inside. Do you remember anything about where you would have, did you write this in school? Would you have been writing at home, in your bedroom, at a desk? Do you remember any of that?
Well, we did have a computer at home. I think this was probably the Apple IIe era.
Nice.
Yeah, probably.
The gray box?
Yes. I think it, you know, it would have been around 1988. Mm-hmm. And I actually think one thing we can talk about is this is really a work of collaboration, as you'll see. And I suspect that my mom may have helped type it.
Awesome. Yeah.
So.
Well, what
so
do you
she's
think?
Invested.
Yeah.
She's put time into it.
Yeah.
I think, like, we need to hear this.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Elizabeth and the Jungle.
And you are welcome to read it straight through. You're also welcome to stop and comment on what you read and what you think.
Okay. All right, well, so the first page is handwritten, and it's a dedication page. Okay, and I'm getting some information from this. I would like to dedicate this book to my mother,
wow.
who typed my story.
Well, there you go.
Mrs. Crookshanks, my teacher, for editing my story. And last but not least, Kathy Weber and Melissa Leonard for the illustrations.
I'm sorry, you were already nailing the dedication and the acknowledgments page the same. Why don't I mean, that's amazing. You put acknowledgments in the dedication.
You were a grateful child.
The last but not least is
last
a,
but
yeah,
not
beautiful.
Well, and I do want to stop and say, so Mrs. Crookshanks, so that tells me this was fifth grade, not fourth grade.
So in your later years.
So in my later years. No, I think, so I was nine. And it's really interesting that I thank Mrs. Crookshanks because I hated
Whoa,
her.
No.
And I, she,
tell us more.
She was a witch. And
do we want to include her real name?
She is dead.
Oh, okay. We're good.
I learned from our friend Vinny yesterday in talking about television writing that you can't defame the dead.
Yeah.
So we're good.
Defame away.
Wow.
No, I do. I remember some lightly racist things that she used to say in class. She treated us horribly. And but clearly I was trying to curry favor.
Oh, but somehow she gave you the assignment, right?
Yeah.
Oh, my
gosh. There a grade?
No, there's no grade as far as I can tell. No.
Crookshank sounds like a teacher in Harry Potter.
I know,
sounds a little
right?
Dickensian.
Yeah. I know.
Crookshank.
That's an amazing.
Well, like Crookshank Redemption.
Yeah.
Different. Yeah. Maybe a different podcast.
Okay, so that's the handwritten dedication. Elizabeth and the Jungle by Leela Doyle Bayok. I included my middle name because that's what authors do.
And Doyle, I mean.
Great name.
Yeah.
Yeah. I never win anything, complained 7-year-old Elizabeth Robinson while she was sitting at the breakfast table eating her Cheerios. Elizabeth was always complaining about something. Even if she had just had the best day of her life, she would find something wrong with it. Then she glanced at the Cheerios box. On the front of it, it said, "Win a trip to the jungle. See back for details." Wow, thought Elizabeth, I've never even been on a plane before. So she sent in the certificate on the back of the box. And then there's an illustration of a girl eating Cheerios at the breakfast table, illustration which I did not.
Okay, but that illustration is amazing.
Yes. Yeah. Well, Melissa Leonard, wherever you are, kudos.
Well,
I mean, that's like outsider art.
Yes. I mean, the toes on this girl are really special, I think.
You had a really high kitchen island. Well, maybe.
We didn't have a kitchen island.
The artist did.
Yes. Okay. 3 weeks later, she received a call saying that she had won a trip to a jungle in South America. She was to leave that day. She couldn't believe her ears. She went downstairs and told her mother, "Mom, Cheerios just called and said that I won the trip to the jungle." "That's nice, dear," her mother replied while continuing to wash the dinner dishes. "Mom, pay attention." Her mother turned around. "Yes, what is it, dear?" "Cheerios just called and said I won a trip to the jungle because of an entry I sent in from the back of the box." "Oh, I didn't hear the phone ring," said her mother, turning back to the dishes. "I'm going to go to my room and get some rest before I leave." So she went upstairs and took a nap. When she awakened, she saw a tree in front of her. She rubbed her eyes. It was there, all right. She looked around. There were vines and plants all over the place. This wasn't her room. This looked like the jungle. "Wow," she cried. "This must be magic. And while I was sleeping, Cheerios transported me here." She looked around again. She saw a gorilla. "Hi, my name is Charlie," it said. "I didn't know gorillas could talk," said Elizabeth. "I didn't either until I came into this story," replied Charlie.
What? That is some meta shit right there.
Breaking the fourth wall here.
Wow. Like, enough about me. Now what about you?
Enough about me.
How did you get here? Oh, wait, sorry. How did you get? And then there's a two-page spread illustration. I mean, again,
These are gorgeous. You had an illustrator.
I had apparently multiple.
And a publisher and an editor. Yes.
And did they sign it in the bottom corner?
Yes. This is by Kathy Weber.
Ooh. Is this a different?
A different illustrator.
What?
Yes.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
She had a whole team.
Yeah.
The whole team.
That's what it takes, you know?
That's what it takes.
Okay, so Charlie says, "Enough about me. Now, what about you? How did you get here?" "I won a trip from Cheerios," she said. "Oh," said Charlie. All of a sudden, Elizabeth was back in her room. A voice boomed, "Did you enjoy your trip, Ms. Robinson?" "Wasn't it just a tad bit too short?" asked Elizabeth sarcastically. The voice laughed. I'm sorry, I forgot to tell you. That was a magic jungle where animals talk and times go faster than here. I don't believe in magic, said Elizabeth stubbornly. Then how do you explain Charlie? The voice questioned. How do you know about Charlie? Elizabeth asked, suspicious. The voice laughed again, seeing the look on Elizabeth's face. I was watching you. Now you'd better get down to breakfast. But it's din... Elizabeth stopped, remembering the time difference. Thanks for the explanation, she said, sulking. She was still mad that the trip had been so short. Anytime, the voice said, and was gone. Elizabeth! It was her mother's voice calling. It's time for breakfast. I'm coming, Elizabeth yelled, racing downstairs. Would you like some Cheerios? Her mother asked. Sure, Mom, Elizabeth said, giggling. What's so funny? Her mother asked. It's just a dream I had, she replied. For by this time, Elizabeth had figured it was a dream because, as I said before, she doesn't believe in magic. But as her mother was pouring the milk, Elizabeth looked out the window and saw... Charlie. The end.
Oh, wait, my
what?
God. Oh.
Can't end. What?
Whoa.
Oh, my God.
I mean, what was that little four by, what was that sentence at the very end? For by this time.
For by this time, Elizabeth
oh, yeah.
had figured.
I mean, that's like,
it
sounds
was a
like,
dream. Because as I said before, it's yeah. an interesting introduction of the first person narrator.
Right. I love the for by this time, though. That just yes. sounds like someone who's read a lot of... stories and books and
this story should that. Come with like a trigger warning because it's like full of dissociation, right?
Yes. Okay. Yes. Well, that so that's an interesting point you make because I think that one of the since this is a therapy session,
yeah, let's go.
One of the sort of discoveries that I made as I went back and was looking at some of my early writing was that I always had this impulse to make people a little bit uncomfortable with my writing.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, you're pulling it off.
And I suspect that some of the kind of meta elements in this story came from a place of not wanting to veer into cliche or sentimentality. Mm-hmm. And that was sort of what my young brain was like reaching for as a way of like destabilizing some of the like familiar narrative structures. Because I think, you know, Lauren, you have a child. You probably have read Where the Wild Things Are within the last 10 years.
Yes.
And it's very clear to me now reading this book that it was a blatant ripoff of Where the Wild Things Are. But darker and that book is dark.
That book is dark, but this goes someplace else in my brain.
Yes. Well, tell me where it goes.
I'll tell you something that I found interesting.
Yeah.
Sorry, Lauren. I just had something I want to say.
She asked me.
Well, but I just have one thing, then we'll get back to you. One thing that I found fascinating was the line where your narrator says, Mom, pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure that everything I wrote when I was a kid, I'm not saying you were doing this, but was to get someone to finally say I was doing something good and successfully.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's interesting that your mom was helping you type this.
Mm-hmm.
And you have a character that's a mom who is sort of not giving the child the attention that she deserves. And the child is strong enough to say, look at me.
Yes.
I matter.
I thought that was really interesting, too, and particularly because I don't – when I look back on my childhood, I don't have an experience of feeling like my mother didn't pay attention to me.
Mm-hmm.
I think she was quite an attentive parent. But now that I'm a mother, I think I do have that fear of, I'm looking at my phone when my kid needs my attention, you know, and are they going to remember that as like an indelible part of their childhood?
So your mom was typing up her own fear.
Yes.
And I love that she was so advanced in her soul's journey that she didn't edit it out. Like, there would be an instinct to be like, no, we're taking that out.
Yeah, totally.
But, you know, the way I read it or heard it was sort of comedic. Like, doesn't she say to her mom, like, you know, Cheerios is sending me to the jungle? And, you know, when you hear your kids say stuff like that, you're probably just like, yeah, whatever, you know. And, and so when she asks her to pay attention, it's funny because it's like she's telling her something crazy.
Yes.
You know? So I felt like there was a comic way to read it, too.
Oh, totally.
Wouldn't there need to be, like, a parent-guardian permission form or?
You know, that's a really good point. I think I'm not
it's
sure.
It's on the back of the box.
I'm not sure that Cheerios Legal vetted this.
Were you paid by Cheerios? Because Cheerios has dropped, I don't know, maybe half a dozen times in here.
I love this sort of sense you get the Cheerios is kind of this sort of mysteriously all-powerful organization.
Well, I mean, it's
not just
it was
a breakfast
the 80s.
Cereal.
Yeah. Like, it was kind of, Cheerios was kind of a big deal, you know?
Well, and Cheerios are very good for your health and cholesterol.
Yes. What about fiber?
Cheerios are high in fiber, which is good for your heart health and cholesterol.
Yeah.
That's a PSA by Lauren Haldeman. I you know, other thing I remember from the 80s, I don't know if this still happens now, but is the way the cereal box, I mean, there were games, there were things you could submit to.
Yeah.
I found really interesting, Leela, just the arc of the narrative. I mean, even now as a poet.
Seriously.
I don't think I could build into enough exposition, you get enough forward momentum, you get an inciting incident, you get the action, you get the climax, and you get the resolution. It all happens.
Yeah, it's amazing.
To me, that introduction of, we're sitting around, we're having the cereal, I'm eating the cereal, I'm going to submit the box, and then you wait a little bit of time, you hear back from them, they call, the character comes downstairs and says, Mom, Cheerios called.
just a brand.
That's why she doesn't stop washing the dishes.
Catherine from Cheerios.
Yeah. Right.
No, and even the language, I mean, the verbs that you use, there's a lot of, I mean, I teach creative writing, and I can't get my students now.
We all teach creative writing, Danny.
Oh.
God.
Well, sorry, I didn't mean it like that.
Yeah, yeah.
What I meant was I'm the only one who teaches creative writing. But when I teach, I find it difficult even now to get students to think about action tags and how to use dialogue to also move the narrative forward. Mm-hmm. And you're already
doing
it.
Yeah, I know. It's scary.
It's really interesting.
Well, it's interesting that you say that because my experience of reading it as somebody who, you know, writes television for a living and is always thinking about story structures and moving story forward, what I notice is that there's no second act. It's like there's a beginning and an end, but as soon as I get to the jungle, I'm right back home. Like, I think I had
you like couldn't commit.
No, I was like, you know, as soon as she meets the talking gorilla, the gorilla says one word pretty much, and then she's back in her bedroom.
I wonder if do you think that's part of somehow of was the larger desire not to really write about the jungle, but to just write about this sort of, something about this brief escape and this sort of very quick return and just sort of how it plays into, I mean, I felt the brevity of the trip to the jungle was somehow important.
Yeah.
Or like it was meant to be brief, and that's why she describes it as a dream, and that's why.
Well, Cheerios can only afford so
much. Right. But it does sound like the voice is ready to take her there again whenever she wants.
Yes.
You know?
The voice.
I forgot about the voice.
Yeah. No, I was really struck by the language too, and the dialogue, it's like, it's so clean and like so, I mean, it's just so amazingly well written, and yeah, I totally agree with Danny. I'm so impressed by the arc. And then what I also loved is that what you left out, you just like didn't describe what she was doing for the 4 weeks while she waited to hear back from Cheerios. It was just a really nice cut. I was like,
is that what it said? 3 weeks later?
I don't.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I think
something
it was,
like that.
I feel like it was. I think
it was a really nice.
Didn't it usually take 6 to 8 weeks?
3 weeks later, she received a call.
Yeah, I mean,
that's pretty quick for back then.
But also, you're moving time forward in a very sophisticated way.
Oh, we're doing
hard to do.
Doing a lot with time in this story.
Yeah, yeah,
we're roughing it up.
I'll tell you something I found interesting when the sort of vines start showing up. It didn't occur to me that it was a dream at first. Like I was fully with this sort of surreal.
Wait,
I didn't think it was a dream.
It wasn't a dream.
I thought it was real.
Oh,
but well, I mean, I think that's part of the thing.
Does the author know?
I think I'm going to go back to context clues here, and I think there is a hidden clue that indicates that Danny's reading might be correct.
Easter egg. And where the wild things are, doesn't the whole room kind of turn into a place?
Yes, which I think is pretty much what I ripped off.
But you think it was a dream? What's the clue?
The clue is Elizabeth comes downstairs. She says, Cheerios just called and said I want a trip to the jungle because of an entry I sent in from the back of the box. Oh, I didn't hear the phone ring, said her mother, turning back to the dishes.
Yeah, I wondered about that too. I just thought maybe either mom didn't hear the phone or Cheerios calls in, like, using the voice.
So my paranoid brain.
The call from Cheerios comes internally.
Right. Yeah. She's descending into psychosis.
Yes. Yeah.
That's where I start to get creeped out.
But that didn't make me, that didn't make me worry that the trip wouldn't be real. I just thought that.
Yeah, but I'm worried for this person's mental health and safety at this point.
No, she seems probably.
I'm interested in how the neighbors are going to respond to Charlie in the backyard.
Yeah.
We were in a conversation yesterday with Gina Welch, who's here visiting, another wonderful TV writer and nonfiction writer who will be on the podcast in the future.
Good friend of mine.
Good friend of Leela's. And she was talking about, was it Aunt Beattie?
Yeah.
Who told her, do you remember what she was talking about?
Yeah.
And she was saying that Aunt Beattie, I might butcher this a little bit, but told her that when you're writing a story, you should always have a bird fly by the window.
Yeah.
It's a metaphorical bird.
Yeah. The idea is that time continues.
And life goes on around
well,
you.
Well, that's something that we talk about a lot. I mean, I had never heard it phrased that way, but it's connected to something I think we talk a lot about in television writing, which is world building, you know, and this idea of always trying to make sure that the world outside of the frame that you're looking at feels real, that you know, the characters are inhabiting a three-dimensional world. And I thought that was a really beautiful way of putting it, and I think it's something that I think about constantly in every scene I write for television. I think a lot of times people think about world building as something that only applies to, you know, a fantasy series like Game of Thrones or something like that, but it's so crucial even in, you know, really grounded storytelling.
So just to be clear, so we're talking about beyond the particular scene or the story, what we're really talking about creating is the sense that not only is the world out there, but it's going about its business sort of completely independently of what's happening with this particular group of characters.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Like
it
doesn't pause like the Truman Show.
And I think that's really, I mean, I think in fiction, that's really hard to do. It requires like a really concentrated, like I read this novel by Sally Rooney called Conversations with Friends, which I really loved. And I thought in that book, she does a really amazing job of that. Like you really have a sense of the characters' lives outside the main central drama.
Yeah.
They get sick, they get injured, they visit their parents. You know, sort of ordinary things happen that make the life feel like it has a real texture.
Yes.
Which I think that's sort of the way I...
Well, it's interesting you bring up fiction and storytelling because... So I met Leela when we were at the writer's workshop. And at the time, you were studying fiction, and now you're writing for television. And I'm curious if you can think about, after you've written this beautiful story, what happens? Like, how do you go from writing this story to ending up at Iowa for grad school to L.A.?
Yeah. So I wrote the story 3 weeks later. I got a call from Cheerios.
I knew it.
3 weeks later, I got a call from Connie Brothers.
Exactly.
The Cheerios of our time.
It's true.
No, I mean, so I grew up in Missoula, Montana, and I think it's a town that is somewhat of a cousin to Iowa City in the sense that it's a college town that is full of writers. So I grew up kind of surrounded by writers. So I think, you know, I often hear other writers talk about the fact that they, you know, didn't know that it was possible to be a writer. And I never had that. I had all kinds of adults surrounding me who were making careers as writers, which was, I think, an incredible privilege, and also sometimes I think a little bit of a curse. because I think I was pegged very early on as somebody who could do this for a living, and I think I felt the pressure of that in a different way. After high school, I went to NYU briefly to study filmmaking, screenwriting. I hated NYU. I came back to the University of Montana and studied creative writing there, and had a great experience. Then applied to graduate school. After college, I did a year-long fellowship in journalism at Mother Jones Magazine.
Wow.
And because I think I thought, like, okay, journalism is a way of making a career as a writer. At that time, it was.
so just to pause a little bit. So when you were in high school, did you get interested in film and screenwriting and sort of, or were you still sort of writing fiction? Like what path did your writing take?
I was interested in screenwriting. That was not something that I had any exposure to. I didn't know any screenwriters in Missoula. I knew a lot of journalists and novelists and, you know, academics. But I met a woman who had come to the University of Montana for graduate school to get an MFA in creative writing, who had worked in Hollywood. And she sort of encouraged me to think about screenwriting a little bit. And so that's what I did. I had started working on a script with a friend, you know, when we were like 15.
Do you remember what it was about?
Yeah, it was about...
Was it about Cheerios? Was it sponsored by Cheerios?
It was not about Cheerios, but it did involve mysterious messages on popsicle sticks.
Oh my goodness gracious!
Okay. I'd watch that movie.
Yeah. The characters were always like eating popsicles, and then the popsicle sticks would have messages that said like, "What do you want?" Mm. And it was sort of this existential, like teenage kind of proto euphoria with some, you know, lightly mystical elements to it.
Nice pitch. Sounded like a pitch.
Yeah. We'll take it.
Yeah.
Cool.
That's what I submitted to NYU. But as I said, I didn't last long at NYU. It was sort of an experience of, like, I got there and they were like, great, here are all the, you know, sound mixing classes you're going to take for the next 4 years. And I was like, I want to take French and dance and, you know, and that was not, it was much more of a kind of technical filmmaking program. Mm-hmm. And I just wanted to be a writer. So anyway, came back, studied writing at the University of Montana, then did a year-long fellowship at Mother Jones Magazine. And then I applied to MFA programs, got into Iowa, and came here and had two of the best years of my life.
And at that time you were writing, you had sort of moved away from scripts and you were writing short fiction, long fiction, but you were writing prose.
I was writing prose, yes. Short fiction. And I studied creative writing in college. So I had written a fair amount and had a lot of experience with the writing workshop, you know, format. So I came to Iowa. You know, had an incredible experience, met the man who had become my husband in my first day of workshop, as well as, a number of people who are still my closest friends. And then after Iowa, I did a fellowship at the Fine Arts Work Center in Provincetown, where Danny also spent some time. And that was an experience of extreme, profound loneliness.
Wow. Okay.
That really cured me of wanting to make a career as a fiction writer.
Interesting.
It is. It's a lonely sport, you know?
Yes. Yes.
People don't really think about that. And I love, too, because you were already collaborating.
Yes.
Yeah, that's so many collaborators.
And yes. I hit that point with my writing too, where I was like, I am so alone. I'm so sick of myself. I can't do this. And collaboration was like the next step forward. It's like, I want some friends to make something with.
Totally. Yes. That I really experienced that as a profound revelation during my time in Provincetown. I just understood that that I could never, especially after having just come from Iowa, which was such a profoundly social experience, yeah. and where everyone was kind of collaborating with each other's work in different ways, to go from that to Provincetown, where I felt totally isolated, was really a kind of whiplash. And so I was kind of like, okay, I'm not going to be a fiction writer.
So you made like a decision. You were like, yeah. I just can't do this.
Yeah, I really did. So the alternative to me was to be a journalist, basically. So Sam and I, my husband and I, wound up, he was not my husband yet, but we moved to New York. And I wound up getting a job at The New Yorker, where I spent about 5 years as a fact checker. And I did a little writing for them too, but mostly I was checking facts, which was amazing. I loved that job, and I loved the experience of being in collaboration with so many other incredibly smart people working at the absolute highest level and in pursuit of a common goal, you know, which was like to put out this incredible magazine every week. And by the way, sidebar, as a fact checker, I'm very disturbed by the fact
that you can't hold that to the same
standard. By the fact
standard.
That there are gorillas in the South American jungle.
Oh, this is a special jungle, though. In the Cheerios jungle.
Yeah.
All the animals.
Well, remember that gorilla? Charlie didn't know how he got there either.
That's true. I guess, you know, that's a fair point.
So I have a question. So just to go back a little bit, I'm glad we're moving forward quickly because it's really interesting. But first of all, what were you reading? Like, who were your sort of the writers that you liked when you came to Iowa and even afterwards?
Yeah.
Like, what kinds of writers did you admire? Or did you sort of
When I came to Iowa, I was absolutely under the spell of Laurie Moore.
Okay.
I you know, just everything I wrote, I think, was kind of a pale imitation of Laurie Moore. I loved George Saunders. I loved John Cheever. Yeah, those were kind of the biggies.
And then all those years at Iowa and then maybe in Providence and in New York, were you like an avid film goer? Did you watch a lot of television? Like before you went to Los Angeles to be a TV writer, were there years of watching TV before that?
Yeah, for sure.
Like where did that interest sort of...
I always loved film and television, but I think that those years after when I was living in New York after graduate school, that was kind of the beginning of like prestige TV. Mm-hmm. And so the idea of, you know, applying my literary skills to television writing just wasn't even a thing until like the mid-aughts. And so I think Sam and I both started, we would watch a lot of TV during that period. You know, we would watch Lost and Friday Night Lights and, you know, these like kind of newer serialized, you know, and they were all on like the broadcast network. It was before, you know, the streaming era.
Right.
So, and fun fact, like, you know, Sam and I would hang on every episode of Lost. I would go on to work on two shows with Damon Lindelof, who created that series.
Wow.
And now Sam and I are rewatching Lost with our two boys.
Oh, man.
Which is so fun, not having watched it for, you know, 15 years or whatever.
Lost is sort of a Cheerios brings me there story.
It is a little bit.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah.
Like, how did we get here and time being different?
Totally.
It's so interesting, too, because I remember... Also, when I was in Provincetown, I remember being very lonely, and that was when Netflix, you were just getting the DVDs in the mail, and so I would, like, wait anxiously for the next DVD to show up, but I remember watching Friday Night Lights and thinking, both in terms of the way it was shot, but just everything you're talking about, it was just a new era of television, right on the heels of Sopranos and Six Feet Under.
Yeah.
And so when you were watching those shows... And having this kind of exciting viewing experience, and then with Sam, how did you go from "that's a cool thing" to working with Damon Lindelof? Yeah, like, how did it go from New York into LA and then actually writing for television?
Yeah. Well, Sam, my husband, started doing some TV writing first. He had a friend from college who had started, who had become a TV writer, and had encouraged Sam to try it out. And so Sam did a little bit of freelance work. At that time, you could still kind of, you know, do a freelance script for a TV show. That doesn't really exist anymore. So Sam did some of that, and then he started writing some pilots of his own and had some success with it. And I think after he sold his second pilot, you know, he got this check from FX, and we were like, I was kind of at the end of my time at The New Yorker. It was sort of the moment where I was like, I can't be a fact checker forever. I was looking at what the next step was, and it was like all these editors, they were never going to leave their jobs. It wasn't like, I wasn't like, oh, there's going to be a job for me at The New Yorker next year. It was like, maybe if I wait another decade, I could possibly have a chance of like moving up the ranks. And in fact, I went to talk to David Remnick, the editor of The New Yorker, about sort of my career. And he said to me, you're a writer, go write.
Oh,
and
nice.
It really meant a lot to me. It was something that, you know, I you know, left The New Yorker and went to be a writer. And so we moved to LA and we sort of thought, we'll try it out for a year. You know, we had this little bit of money from a pilot that Sam had sold. And so we were just like, okay, we'll give it a year. And then it worked out. And within, I mean, Sam got a job staffing on the first season of Masters of Sex, the Showtime series. And while he was working on that show, a pilot that he had written when we were living in New York sold and was getting made, and he was going to be the showrunner. And so I went to work with him on that show, and that was Manhattan, about the development of the atomic bomb in Los Alamos. And it was just this incredible experience. You know, this was a moment, this was 2014, I want to say. And it was a moment when these tiny little networks no one had ever heard of were suddenly making scripted television shows. Mm-hmm. And from the perspective of 2024, they weren't paying very much for them. But we sort of figured out with our incredible director, Tommy Shalami, who had directed a lot of The West Wing, how to kind of make this show very inexpensively on location in New Mexico. And it became, Sam and I had just had our first kid. We kind of went out to Santa Fe with our baby, and the whole cast and crew were kind of living in this town that we'd made in the middle of the desert. And it really felt like we were, you know, like these scientists who had moved their families to Los Alamos to work on this insane project.
We were living it.
Yeah, we were kind of living it, and it was incredible. And so that was kind of my, you know, I got thrown into the deep end a little bit with my first experience of TV writing, but I just absolutely loved it. I loved the collaboration. Mm-hmm. It felt like this totally new kind of writing that just clicked for me. It was sort of what I had been missing as a fiction writer.
When a show ends, what does that feel like? You've created this sort of family. You've actually created a town in New Mexico. Is that sounds hard to me?
But it's a little sad.
It was incredibly sad, and we are still very close to almost everyone we made that show with. Yeah, it was really painful when it ended. But I was so lucky. One of the writers on Manhattan was a writer named Tom Spezialy, who had then gone to work on The Leftovers with Damon Lindelof. And I submitted myself, or my agent submitted me for a job on the third season of The Leftovers, and Tom Spezialy kind of made sure that Damon Lindelof read my work, And
these last names sound made up. I'm just going to say. No offense. But I believe you.
Yeah. And so I went to work on the third season of The Leftovers,
wow.
Awesome. Which was an incredible experience.
And so for our audience members who might not know or have had the chance to hear people talk about a writer's room, when we started this, we talked about collaboration, everything from the book you read from mm-hmm. Your youth to then being at a place like Provincetown where you're sort of recognizing that you wanted that collaborative environment. Some people might think of a television script or a film script where they're sort of writing it on their own, but that's not what happens really in a writer's room. What did you gain from the kind of collaborative spirit of a writer's room? And maybe could you describe briefly sort of what that's like?
Yeah. So I think, you know, when most people think of what a writer does, they think of somebody alone in their room, you know, typing. As a writer in a writer's room, you know, you are hired as by a showrunner who has their own vision for the series they're trying to write, and your job as a writer in the room is to service that vision. And so most days when you're in the writer's room, you're not actually writing in the sense of sitting at a computer. What you're doing is you are in concert with the other writers around the table, pitching ideas for the show and, you know, trying to what we call break the story, you know, figure out what these characters are doing from scene to scene to move the story along. And so it's an incredibly collaborative experience. And in fact, on the shows that I've worked on with Damon Lindelof, we actually write everything together in the room.
Cool.
I mean, on a series of whiteboards.
You write every episode in the room together?
Pretty much.
Wow.
I mean, the scripts then get assigned to different writers and somebody's name goes on them. But by the time that happens, we have, as a group, figured out exactly what every scene is down to the level of most of the dialogue in the scene.
Wow.
So you're never being sent off to write a script and looking at a blank page. You're kind of like, okay, I'm sort of fleshing out the, you know, the ligaments here, but it's pretty much already there with the work we've done as a group.
Cool.
Wow. So do you think, it always occurs to me that like a writer's workshop where like at Iowa or any other MFA program where someone brings in their story and everyone sort of gathers around and tries to figure out how to help that story. I'm talking about a workshop at its very best in
yeah.
its ideal form to try to help that person bring their work to its highest fruition, whether you like it or not, you know. I always thought that seems very similar in some ways to a writer's room and that you
yeah.
have to sort of buy into this.
Yes.
You have to collaborate to help the writer make their work, bring it to fruition. Do you feel like workshops were helpful to you when you got into a writer's room, or did you have other things that you felt like you had done in the past that made you suited or comfortable in a writer's room?
Oh, absolutely. I say that all the time. I think that being at the writer's workshop was an incredible preparation for being in a TV writer's room. And it's exactly what you say. When it's working or when you are doing your job as a member of the workshop, you are trying to imagine your way into the best version of the story that somebody else is trying to write.
Mm-hmm.
And so it has to not be about you or what you would do. It has to be about how to service somebody else's vision. And I think that's something that, you know, TV writing is not for every writer.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of incredible prose writers who would be death in a writer's room because they don't have that skill set of
right.
sort of being able to pitch into somebody else's vision. It's they know how to service their own vision. And that's not by no means a knock because I don't think I can do the other thing.
Right.
I think that like for me the interplay
we need all
is
types.
Crucial. Yes.
It seems like
yes.
you need a lot of there was a conversation last night where Vinny and Gina Welch and Vinnie Wilhelm were talking about the writer's room and just how it sounds to me like you really have to just be so selfless in a way at certain times and so open and generous. I mean, it just seems like that you have to have a lot of humility, which never kind of occurred to me before.
Yeah, I mean, it helps when you're collecting a paycheck.
Yeah.
I think it's harder, you know, it can be harder in a writer's workshop where you're, you know, I think everyone is still trying to prove themselves mm-hmm. somehow. But yeah, you really have to check your ego at the door, because a lot of times in a writer's room, you might feel like, well, my idea is the best. But if you just doggedly hang on to your own idea, you will take the whole room backwards. So it has to always be about moving forward into building on everyone else's ideas.
Leela, speaking about moving forward.
Yes.
So as you sort of continued your career, I mean, you went on, I feel very fortunate to know you and to know Sam. Manhattan was so incredible. And still to this day, I rewatch it like once a year.
Oh, my
it's
God.
So beautiful.
The Thank you for the residuals.
So, that's what I'm hoping. The acting is so great. The writing is so great. And similarly, you know, I mean, the other shows you've worked on, Watchmen, you won an Emmy for that. It's so incredible to see all the work you've done. I'm curious what, maybe if you can talk about it, what are you working on now?
Yeah, I have a number of projects that I'm developing, like new TV series. One is it's a romantic comedy with A24, an ongoing series. And another is an adaptation of a Swedish thriller that is going to be set in my home state of Montana. But both of those are sort of in early, at very early stage. And I'm also writing a feature that I hope to direct.
Oh my gosh. Wow. Love that you can do so, like you can do a romantic comedy and a thriller and a feature. Yeah. Like speaking of
the
what
feature,
I think,
by the way, is a horror movie set in Provincetown.
Wow.
Sign me up.
Yes.
I just love that it seems like with television, we hear a lot, at least in the sort of literary fiction and sort of worlds that many of us came from for the workshop. There's like a lane you have to be in,
mm-hmm.
And sort of genres mm-hmm. looked at poorly.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like with television and film, there's a lot of ability to try mm-hmm. many things, and that's really exciting.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. What was that?
That was like a wave.
I didn't hit any buttons.
That was incredible.
That was Cheerios.
That was Cheerios. That was the voice.
Yeah. Yeah.
The voice is saying, we're getting to the end.
Well,
it's time for Lauren to ask her question.
Yeah,
that's what the voice was saying, Stephen.
Yeah.
All right, we're going to get in the TARDIS and time travel again.
All right.
So we're going to go back to you
okay.
in that classroom or where you were writing this
yeah.
book about Elizabeth in the jungle. That little you,
mm-hmm.
what would she think of where you are now?
Oh, man. I think she would be like, wow, you write television. Have you ever written an episode of The Love Boat?
Yeah.
I think, you know, it's been an interesting journey going back to this early work, because I think in a way there's a remarkable consistency to – and I guess that's maybe the thesis of your show. I don't know. I think the genre that I was exploring here in Elizabeth in the Jungle, which I think is sort of like grounded character drama with some mystical or unexplainable elements that disrupt the flow of the narrative. I think that's still what I'm doing wow. in almost everything I work on. So I think, I don't know, I guess 9-year-old me would find myself familiar.
That's amazing.
Leela, thank you for being our guest today. Thank you, and Sam, for all the work you did to Elizabeth in the Jungle.
Overnight. FedEx postage
out here, and congratulations on all the success. You always have a home here in Iowa City. It's so great to see you.
Thank you so much.
We look forward to talking more soon.
Well, thank you. This was a delight.
Yeah.
Being here, and you'll be hearing from my insurance.
Support for this podcast comes from the University of Iowa, the Magid Center for Writing, the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences, and the Graduate College. We'd like to thank the Center for Language and Culture Learning for use of their podcast studio. Sad Me of the Past is part of the Writing University Podcast Network at the University of Iowa. This network includes podcasts from creative writing programs and departments all across our campus. Visit writinguniversity.org/podcasts to see our full list of offerings, including Writing Matters, The 11th Hour, Origins, The Short Coat, and more.